This is a conversation with Amy Morrison, who is a professor at the University of Waterloo. Amy and I have known each other for a long time. We met in university residence. We were in the same program in our undergrad. We worked in the same computer lab, and our lives were pretty intertwined in those years. But in the years since university, I haven't seen a lot of Amy, and where I went on to try and sell people things on the internet, Amy went on to study the internet academically. And as a result, she gets called upon all the time by media to explain what is going on, like what is going on with what's going on with the kids on the internet. And so she and I exchanged a bunch of messages over the years on Twitter. I guess that's how we have chosen to stay in touch, either publicly or through direct message. And so I had asked her to join me for a podcast recording a while ago. And she threw back at me this flood of memories describing when our life in our third year literary theory class was like. This conversation, this podcast recording is really just me dropping you into a conversation with an old friend. And so I hope you enjoy it. We can start with your message because it blew my mind. The level of detail remembering our third year English lit class. Holy shit, all of that happened. I remember the room, and MC Leps, still probably the best university course I took, period. Couldn't every class have been that? But then that probably would have killed you.
Sure.
Like if every class had been that class, that you would have just, they probably want to leave after a year of that. But like yourself, although I don't have my notes, I threw, at some point I purged
That's
everything.
Because you're not a professor. I still use those.
I have many of the books from that class still. Like everything else I got rid of, but I didn't get rid of those.
The Dover edition of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yes, and I held on to a lot of my Norton anthologies for a long time, but then I'm like, I'm never going to read these again. But I also, what's the Terry Eagleton literary theory?
Yeah, Dogs Must Be Carried on the Escalator. I met him. He's nice. He liked my writing. That's my, yes. He remains awesome.
But do you feel like you're succeeding?
I feel like I have succeeded, yeah, because Terry Eagleton was like, well, that thing you wrote, I enjoyed that. It's like, oh, yay.
But it also reminded me of the other computer lab, not the main lab, the Scott Library, but the like dungeon computer lab over in Vanier. Because now that I'm teaching at Georgian, the contract instructor room is exactly that room. It's fluorescent lighting, no windows, no blocks. It's a little less gray, probably better lit, but it's still got that really oppressive Joe versus the volcano vibe to it.
If the doomsday clock gets where it's going, that's the room you're going to want to be in.
Gotta be safe.
Underground, it's got the fluorescent lights. It already says post-apocalyptic.
I mean, it is on the second floor.
I don't know how they can be so dark even when they're on. Like, we have some in the building that I work, Hagee Hall, the humanities built in 1972, like a brick shit house. All the classrooms are interior facing. So the faculty office is around the outside in a sort of intestinal design. It's like to maximize windows for people who have offices. And then all the classrooms are in the interior spaces of that. So like day, night, you don't know. Like nobody has any idea. And they've just repainted them a color that my colleague calls retina burn white. It's like a white that somehow seems to be whiter than white, but also depressingly gray at the same time. But like there's nowhere to look where your eye isn't just like squinting the whole time. That was better than the brick, they thought, I guess, somehow. Really warmed it up. No.
They probably got a good deal. Like they probably got a good deal on that paint. And they're like, we need a lot of it. So let's go for it.
And the raw brick was so in 1972. You know?
Yeah, and you know, as so many of those university institutional buildings are, they just reek the 1960s, 1970s. Like I've shared so many times, the York University, it's tank accessible. Yeah,
that's right.
It's just in
case. Gatherer of wind. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was also struck, Amy. I was Googling you.
I hope you found the Amy that's me, because there's other ones out there, which I found deeply offensive, you know, because like it's an unusual name and I didn't think that there ought to be anybody else with the same name.
You didn't think?
No, an Amy Moore, like a French first name and this like Scottish last name. Like, what the hell?
Mm. Really? That got to you? During COVID, maybe just before COVID, I realized there was another guy named Matt Groudon on LinkedIn. And COVID being such a dark time, at some point in many of the self-induced thought experiments I did while I was sitting in this office, I was like, how many are there? I found three other Matthew Groudons.
Doppel Groudons.
I befriended them. And I, you know, yeah, they're not all one T. I think one was a one T. The other two were two T.
You see, you try to go with a weird spelling and you're like, that's it. I'm an individual. As it turns out, No.
But I wrote a lovely intro email that said something to the effect of, you know, in these trying times, us Matthew Groudons must stick together. And I thought we should all connect.
That's nice.
And so we all connected on LinkedIn. And yeah, and now I really like and re-up his stuff. One of them is very active in the UK and finance. And so he's actually doing kind of interesting things.
Wow. But like, what a way to meet people, right? Hi, we have the same name. Okay.
I mean, it's as good a reason as any. As you know, as opposed to we live in the same university residence. It's not so much different.
No.
But your results are spectacular because of the Google Scholar. Are you a celebrity? What is going on here?
I do a lot of talks and they always want a photo. And that's the kind of stuff that like pops up high on the Google searches. And I do a lot of media too. And so like if you're CBC or Global or like whatever it happens to be, like it's going to bump up a bit higher in the search results. And sometimes they ask me for photos and sometimes they just go and find one. And like, I'm like, oh, what is that one? Or like, that's like obviously a selfie that was not for this. Or like, that was my yoga teacher profile picture. This is not appropriate for work context. But yeah, I'm all over it. I'm definitely not hidden on the internet.
You are not hidden. I have noticed. You do a lot of media. What is, why? Why, like, why are they reaching out? But also, let's talk about Peak Onesie.
Yeah, sure. Hit me with Peak Onesie.
Like that exploded.
It did. That was like a bunch of things. I actually wrote about that. I have a scholarly article about that.
I read it.
Okay, thanks. That's good. You will recognize it as sounding like me, right? Because they all sound like me.
I did.
Yeah, so it was funny about that was like right place, right time. And if I'd known it was going to be that big, I think I would have written it more carefully. Because normally, like at this point, if I'm writing something, I'm expecting it to get some attention. I will just do 3 minutes of looking for the right hashtags. I just remember bashed it out before class and went to class, came back from class, was like, oh no, what is happening on my Twitter? And all kinds of things were happening on my Twitter. And that just, so it was my friend Christine had taken a picture at Target when we still had Target in Canada of these two onesies, like infant sleepers. And one said, was it Man of Steel and like Superman's future girlfriend or something like that. And one was blue, obviously, and one was pink. And so she put it on Facebook and I was like, can I put this on Twitter? Like, thank God I asked, honestly, in retrospect. And she was like, yes. So I accredited her with that on Twitter and I posted it. I was like, you know, great. These are sexist. And then it just resonated. There was some other things happening at the same time, like a Wear Your Superheroes Day in Australia that was going at the same time that tied in with some like comic book representation and what kind of superheroes girls could be. And then somebody else in Australia had a piece of like Batman and Batman's wife on infant pajamas, right? And people kept sending me these infant pajamas, which was like, you can't date me, my dad will kill you kind of thing, like future heartbreaker for boys. And for girls, it was like, daddy says no, right? Or like whatever it was just appalling, you know, for infants that don't even have any teeth yet, right? So that went kind of big. And I noticed because a lot of academics were going viral for different things at this time, I was paying attention to the differential ways in which having tenure made that easier for me, or where I was more credible as an expert because I was a white lady, less so would it have been if I had been racialized, right? I did get some insults from people like, go make me a sandwich, or like, you have a big nose, which that's true. Okay. Right. Like, they thought, well, we're going to call you ugly, or going to say, like, no one will ever love you, you shrew. And I'm like, oh, joke's on you. I'm married. And that kind of thing. But I was aware of how that cycle of viral touched me differently, especially since I was like, my research area is social media. So I kind of understand how this works. So I was not at all flummoxed. I knew what to do about it. And I thought, well, that's kind of a privilege to not be completely thrown existentially for a loop there. It took a lot of time. It's weird. It goes, when you go viral, it like eats up a lot of your time, remarkably. I was very surprised by that. But yeah, so I'm very good at getting attention, which you might have known about me in the past, Matthew.
What?
Yeah, I was my hand up, right? I'm always wearing some crazy outfit. And was like, I have ideas. So
those ideas to yourself, write them down.
Exactly. Yeah. Write them down on Twitter, right? Was kind of my thing. So that was okay for me. Yeah.
The onesie example was such a great example of right time, right place. And maybe if you'd actually thought about it, it wouldn't have worked so well. Like maybe if it wasn't almost accidental, I wonder if the accidentalness like factors into it.
So you're thinking it might, if I'd been thinking about it, have been more forced or labored, but I would say, well, probably not, because I'm actually skilled at this, right? And if I had brought, you know, attention in that
full weight
to it, right? The full weight of my attention to it. Like I can see sometimes people like overwork it or overthink it, or they're like a little bit of a try hard going on there, but like, I know how to do this. So like, I wasn't even trying to do this. I was like, shit, I would have like spell checked out a bit better. I would have found a better hashtag, or I would have linked to something else additionally to this, or I would not have left it alone for an hour and a half, not knowing where it was going to. But like, I've gone viral a bunch of times. Actually, I had one during the pandemic as well about like how to do online lectures, because like people were struggling, man. Like people were trying to record these 90-minute lectures. They would get permission to go to campus and set up like the big camera at the back of the 600-person lecture hall and like lecture with their, you know, their body mic on to be broadcast to the room. Like, I was like, listen, nobody wants to watch that. Like, nobody wants to be there. Like, there was this weird thing where people were trying to replicate everything in the in-person classroom, even if it was suboptimal in an in-person classroom and way less than suboptimal in an online classroom. They were just like really busy trying to reproduce that. And I cut everything down to like 2 minutes or less. And I would put like chyrons across them, right? I have like little pop-up bubbles and stuff. And I would only do it if students would send me a question. And then I would put their question up on the screen. And then I would do a little video to make it interactive. And I saw a lot of boring videos that people were like, maybe if I add more PowerPoints, I'm like, well, now it's going to be boring with more PowerPoints. I was like, don't try to reproduce the classroom. Try to work in the kind of YouTube vlogger intimacy and interactivity. Like do an AMA and then answer questions in your video. Don't make it like, for God's sake, 90 minutes long, right? Oh God, I would never. Like my little ADHD brain would just have flunked out of school immediately. Like I just, no thank you. So yeah, I've done that. And there's like one I wound up about like academics whining about the powers that be when actually they are the powers that be. And then that got picked up and reprinted. A tweet got reprinted as an article in the CAUT bulletin, the Canadian Association of University Teachers bulletin. Yeah, I don't control exactly what's going to go big. There's been things I thought were going to get picked up and didn't, but a lot of things that I was like, I bet you this is going to track, like have tracked.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I dropped out of university back in the day and then decided to finish during COVID.
Sure. It's a good time for it.
Right. Well, you know, I had some time. I was sitting here at my desk, but my professor did exactly what you just described. But she like her videos would never be more than like 2 to 5 minutes.
Okay. Yeah.
But she also would share slides, like Google Slides. And my favorite part of her Google Slides, and I talked to her about this because I tried to consume as many of her office hours as possible because no one else was.
That's right.
No one else was.
Good. Good for you. We encourage that.
Right? No one else was there. So, but she would put Easter eggs in the slides. Mm-hmm. She would make, and I was like, this is really entertaining. Like, you're really thinking this through and no one is catching this. Like, no one is paying. So she would link to something, and sometimes she was even kind of hiding the link. She was kind of burying it, but there were Easter eggs in every week's set of slides. And I was like, this is actually real.
I love that.
But also in the Google search, among the other things that someone reached out to you for that I didn't know what this was, or, you know, my brain very quickly went to Star Trek was Borgs. What is this?
Well, blackout rate gallons. That's like, that was one of those things that was really funny. I'd seen it online. That's like a kind of professional hazard. I tell people I fart around on the internet for a living because I do. And so I'd seen these, it's a new way to binge drink, basically. You know, it's like, they used to have like jungle juice. Like it's you put it in a Gatorade bottle or whatever, then you can drink in public, but nobody knows you're drinking in public. And it was like all kinds of punches like this. And this is just the latest iteration. It's called a blackout rage gallon. And it's like a big, big gallon tub, you know, like you would get like the 4 liters of milk in kind of thing. And you pour an obscene amount of alcohol in it and then like an electrolyte beverage. So it's like healthy. So like the kids are like, listen, you gotta stay hydrated when you're binge drinking. And they're like, this is healthier because it has a cap and you're carrying around your own like 50 pounds of liquid in this jug. No one's gonna roofie you. And I'm like, girl, listen, that's still binge drinking. It's not good for you. But what distinguished them too was like they would put sassy sayings on the side of it, like little puns about things. Like one was like a Heisenberg. Like it was a physics student called it like a Heisenberg instead of a Heisenberg and stuff. And I thought, like, I was in the middle of giving this news interview and I had a research idea. I was like, oh, I know why this is a thing now. Because instead of your binge drinking being something you're hiding in your circle of friends, you know, to-go coffee cups that are full of gin or whatever it happens to be, you've made it so visible and you've written slogans on the side of this giant container so that you can have a picture of yourself taken with it. It's for distribution on Instagram. So it's a more kind of, it's a more visually decodable way that both individualizes you because you've got your own sassy saying on the side of it and marks you still as a member of an in-group that's, you know, going to parties and, you know, the party's going to be so wild that you need, you know, horse killing amounts of alcohol on your person at all times. But like with coconut water in it because you want to be healthy and it's vegan or whatever it happens to be, but they're very photographable. And I thought, oh, this is binge drinking for the social media age. Mm-hmm. That just occurred to me when the reporter was asking me questions. I was like, yeah, keep asking. I'm getting smarter.
There is no proof of what we did, University, right? There's so very little evidence. There's very little photographic.
Well, I mean, I have a lot of photographic proof. This is what happens when you're friends with people who are taking fine art photography courses for like 40 years in a row, right? I have so many more pictures of that time than I do on the years either side of it. Like before, I really got a digital camera. I had that camera all the time because I had to be taking pictures all the time. And I was taking pictures of the people around me. It was like you, it was Sean, it was my sister, you know, Patty and Megan would come to visit. I would take pictures of the people I know and the places that I know. And I'd be like, Bev is in there a lot. I have like, so it's beautifully documented. If anybody ever wants to make a documentary about any of us, if Ken Burns comes calling, like I have the black and white photographs there, the beautifully shot archival photos of when we were young. Cause I do have a lot of those photos, which I just found again and looked at them for a while. And I was looking at the contact sheets because, like, obviously it's expensive. Like, kids today don't know, but it used to be expensive to have photographs, right? You had to get them printed. And I used to do these in black and white in my photography class. And we would print them on, like, 8x10 sheets of paper. And each piece of paper cost, like, 75 cents or something. And it was, like, major ordeal. So you'd make these contact sheets, which is you'd squish all 36 images in a glass plate against a photo paper, and then on 1 8x10 you would get 35 tiny thumbnails, basically. And so I was looking at those thumbnails with, you know, the fancy magnifying glass you used to get with those things, and I was like, oh my god, I have so much of the early 90s is documented here that I completely forgot that I had. And it made me kind of happy to have it, not online, you know, just to have it and be surprised by it again.
I think I have at least two photos that you took in that era. I have the, we talked about this a little while ago on Twitter. I have a photo you took of, you know, absurd things we did when we were, you know, bored and young. But I think it was juggling.
Oh, Honest Ed's.
Juggling cookies and Honest Ed's. You took a photo of Joanne and I outside of the AGO, which is still a great photo. And I have actually outside the office here, it's not a photo. It's a photo you took theoretically, but you took a photo of my photo of.
Of Trent Reznor. Yeah. It's copyright infringing.
I think the original copy was also copyright infringement because I bought that from a guy on Young Street.
Yeah, I know.
The thing you can do. So it's like, which is funny because it goes very well with the more, although, you know, more recent Nine Inch Nails song, A Copy of It. I am a copy of a copy of it. So I don't think he rhymes.
Anticipating. We were just anticipating.
Yeah. He doesn't give a shit.
He doesn't give a shit.
Yeah. He's just not happy he wasn't nominated for another Oscar this year.
That's fair. I made copies of that for everybody too. I had a copy of that. Megan had a copy of that. I gave copies to everybody of that. This was like, I didn't have to take the picture. I just have to print it. That I can do. No problem. Right?
What else was I going to say here? So more recently, I guess last year, you did a keynote address, closing remarks at the Festival of Teaching and Learning. Sounds fun. Was there... Are there costumes at the Festival of Teaching?
There were no costumes. People were dressing like grown-ups. I was quite disappointed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you spoke about AI.
Sure did.
You spoke about, tell me about that. Talk about that a little bit.
Listen, it's not writing. It's not. The Festival of Teaching and Learning. I was so excited to go. When I got invited, they were like, oh, it's a hybrid event. You can do it virtual or you can come in person. I was like, can I come in person? Right? And they're like, you want to come for one day? I'm like, I want to go to the conference, right? Like, it feels weird to have to ask for this now. But like, I'm mid-career. So this summer, it'll be 20 years since I started at the University of Waterloo. And like, it turns out sometimes, like, this is not a boast. This is to remind myself of my responsibilities. Sometimes I am the person at the cocktail party that other people want to meet. People want to network with me, right? And sometimes people have read my stuff and they want to meet me. And like, if somebody's going to pay me, right, like give me an honorarium for this type of thing. And if they're paying me for that, they're not just paying me to go like and read a paper often, I think. Like what they ought to be getting is me as well, you know? So I like to go there and I like to go to the session.
All in the experience. The full.
Well, like, I don't want to be like, I'm just going to fly in on the last day and like tell y'all what's what and then go for dinner with the people that I know already. Do you know what I mean? Like, if it's a conference and people are going to learn from me, I want to learn from them too. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's kind of how it is. And I get to go and I go and it's at Edmonton where I did my PhD. And like the whole thing is kind of suffused with this AI anxiety. The whole thing, I heard some grad students talking about how they need generative AI to help them do their lit reviews for their papers because there are too many things to read. And I was like just horrified because like a lit review, when I do lit reviews, I mean, obviously I can't read everything. I'm just one person. I read really fast, but like not that fast. Like you read as much as you can, as relevant as you can. And often what happens in that process is I change my ideas, right? That's what's supposed to happen. And it's like, it's not like you read it so that you can put the citations in and you've covered your ass on something. Like reviewing the literature, like ought to be called learning from the literature, right? And they were like, well, there's too many things that we need to publish more, right? And if we're going to publish more, we don't have time to read the things that we're reviewing of published work. I was like, well, what the hell is happening here? So you don't have time to read because you have to write more things that then are going to increase the number of scholarly articles that other people now feel overwhelmed by and don't have time to read. I was like, well, that's crazy, right? It's this idea that ideally AI is pitched to us as a tool of augmentation, right? In the same way, like if I wear these little silicone lobster claws I got from IKEA. I can take hot pans out of my oven without burning my hands. Like, that augments my ability to touch hot things, right? But what we often get is automation, right? Which is the smart oven will know when your food is cooked and like remove it for you and put it on this thing. Except once it gets one too many software updates, now you have to buy a whole new oven because it's not repairable, right? So what I saw at that conference was this real confusion of augmentation and automation. I saw people who were very, very concerned about students are going to cheat with this, right? How are we going to prevent them from cheating with this? And I was like, wow, that's like pretty harsh. And then there were some other people who were like, you know, we're using these tools so that we can scale up what used to be a 200-person class to a 2,000-person class. We have a lot of TAs, but they're all second-year students in their undergrad. I was like, what is happening, right? It's taking the human out of education. A lot of these computer tools are about scaling up, you know, better, faster, or cheaper. Pick two. We always seem to pick like faster and cheaper and more, right? And it's never better, which is funny because like I'm the computer person in my department, you know, like that's my field is new media studies and internet history and like hardware. And like Java is my second language for my PhD. Like I know what I'm doing, right? And I'm like, whoa, guys, this is, these are the end times. Oh, no. Slow down, right? So like Cory Doctorow has this great phrase, which like I wish I'd heard before. I was like struggling for something on my own. He was like, it's not writing, which is what I knew. Like, you know how this works. Like a large language model is like an infinite number of monkeys with an infinite number of typewriters. It's just grind. It's just grinding, right? Is all it is. It's brute force comparison of tokens to other tokens to determine probability of collocation, right? So that's old timey computer words to say. It does not understand words. Doesn't understand characters, understands tokens, and it compares.
Doesn't understand anything.
It doesn't understand. It compares. It compares tokens. It's just like, is this like this thing? Is this like this thing? Okay, these things usually go together. Let's do it like this, right? It's like intensely laborious in terms of like resources employed. And we're just like throwing money and money and money and money and money at teaching computers how to write. And we're taking money and money and money and money out of teaching humans how to write. Do you know? And I don't think it's writing if there's no humans, because writing is communication. Writing is the ideas. One of my undergrads said in his like final report this year, he's like, I think writing is the closest thing we have to telepathy. It's a way to get ideas out of one person's head into another person's head. I was like, yeah, that's right. You know, so the thing that gets me about AI is everybody is so busy being sort of mystified by the glamour. I read it by glamour. I mean, like literally a cast spell, like we would have taken in like the Gothics class. We would have learned about this.
Castro?
That's the Romantics class. He's like still one of my favorite profs. I will just tell you, once he said to me when he handed back, you were in that third year Romantics, the six Romantic poets with me, right? And he was like, do you remember we had that first one in-class essay? And he gave them back and he was like, you guys have to do another in-class essay. You're not allowed to go home and write. This was so bad. Like,
in first year, you weren't in my first year literary survey with him, where he said to the class, which is still brilliant. Yeah, I probably should have said this to my students this year. He said, for those of you who have heard that university English programs are difficult and are afraid of failing, don't be, because as far as I'm concerned, you've all failed already.
Yes, that's the kind of thing he would say. Yeah.
And it's your job to prove to me that you did not fail, that you did not fail.
Yeah, I had him the next year and he would come into class and he would just sit down sort of like hunched over, cantankerous. He'd look around, like, first of all, this is a first year course and it was 12 students and a tenured professor. That was like in a different century. Just like, let's hold on. It is possible to teach like this, right? And he would sit down, he like had the neck, he was like really leaning into like cranky old man. And he would like look out and go, ugh, students. And he'd pick up his coffee and take a big swig and go, I love gin in the morning. He was like greatest.
He was working before it was cool. He was a pioneer.
With his coffee cup. Yeah. So, yeah, AI, people are glamorized by it. They're like, ooh, isn't it amazing? It knows how to use a semicolon. And I'm like, bitch, please. Like, anybody who takes the time can learn how to use a semicolon. But if you read what it writes, quote unquote, if you read the text strings it produces, it's this, like, I teach a lot of first-year students, and I recognize this mode of writing. It has two names, running out the clock, which is put in until you get the word count. Like, you just want to hit the word count and move on. So you're running out the clock on this assignment. And the second part is trying not to be wrong. When students write in such a way that they don't actually know what they're talking about, but they're trying to disguise that with abstractions. Since the beginning of time, man has always wondered about the nature of feminism, or like whatever it is. Like, before we begin, we must define feminism. The dictionary defines feminism, but that's what it does. Like, students do this when they don't know what they're talking about, but they want to sound like they know what they're talking about. There's nothing concrete. There's nothing specific. So all the nouns are like about justice and not about like the reform of bail conditions, right? So like, it's abstract versus concrete, and it's not specific or particular, and they're just trying to say things that are in the topic area that are not egregiously incorrect. And that is actually how ChatGPT writes. It is in the topic area without being egregiously incorrect. But it is often not factual too, because it's not like, so Cory Doctorow calls it a automatic plausible sentence generator. And I'm like, yeah, that's right.
So I remember, you know, obviously he's not at Google either, but I remember sitting in on a presentation with Jeff Hinton. But he was trying to explain to a bunch of, you know, ad salespeople how transformers worked. And we were all like, I don't know what he's saying, but it sounds really important. Like, we were all like, I cannot quite comprehend, but I'm sure this is very important. It sounds very important. Do you think there's a world where it's indistinguishable, where it is better? I mean, yes, there's going to be a massive cost to try and get there, but as the models get better.
Well, I don't think the models are going to get better, right? Because I don't. Like, have you been on the internet lately?
Easy.
Okay, right. I don't know if you've noticed, but Google is getting stupider, right? Search is turning up. A lot of the autocompletes in search now are nonsensical, and they lead you to SEO, mass-generated AR garbage. Lee and I were talking about it on our podcast. One, I was looking up how to do inset sleeves. I'm sewing again, right? I got my mom's sewing machine after she died, and so now I'm sewing because, like, why not have more interests? And I was like looking up sleeves, and this one is like, how to sew sleeves. Before we begin to sew sleeves, it is important to know what sleeves are. Sleeves are a type of garment covering, right? And then like the next heading is like, what are sleeves? What is sewing sleeves? What is sewing?
So you're saying the internet is written by first year English students.
I'm saying the internet now is getting so overloaded with generated content that it's like good writing on the internet was already a needle in a haystack, but we just keep adding more haystack. And one of the reasons the models, you know, after Kevin Roos had that thing where the AI told him to leave his wife and be with it instead, like famously, they started pulling the plug. You could only have so many interactions in a row with the AI before the session would shut down, because the longer it interacted, the more hallucinations it would have, right? The more errors, major errors it would begin to make. But every pass that the learning tool is going to make over the future internet, let's be honest, they're not scanning new stuff for this. They're not soliciting writing. They're scraping off the internet. They're going to be scraping up more and more AI writing, which means the gargoyles that exist in the way AI currently writes, which are massively published on the web now way faster than human beings can write even a fraction of that content, the training data is now corrupted. So it needs human writing in order to get better. But what it's trying to do is replace human writing. Do you know, I think the whole exercise is very cynical, very, very cynical. Like, what is wrong with people writing? Where was the problem there?
And I don't think it's singularly the problem that the models are trying to solve. It's like many pieces of technology. People ask, why was books one of the first things that became popular to sell and ship on the internet? And that's because it fit in a box. It fit in a box nicely. Like, unlike refrigerators or lawn tractors, you know, it was easy to put a book or a CD, CDs, in a box and ship it. Oof. And from my perspective, I think the current language models, they're focused on text because text is easier. Mm-hmm. But that won't be the only thing that they focus on. And your Midjourneys and your Dallies and your other, you know, visual computational learning models, they're trying to scratch a different itch. I hear you. I think, you know, what will inevitably have to happen is not unlike the early days of the internet. There are lawsuits. Mm-hmm. And then there's going to be licensing,
yeah.
Right? That the models are going to have to be written or built off of written content that was written by humans that is licensed, or else some people are going to have to pay a lot of money to other people.
Do you know where I get stuck? Here's where I get stuck. Do you remember Aaron Schwartz, one of the co-founders of Reddit, right? So he died in 2013. I think he committed suicide because he was staring down possibly 100 years in jail from a federal investigation. He had access to MIT. He was there as a visiting fellow or something, and he put a laptop in a storage closet in the library and was making articles on JSTOR available on the internet, right? And they were going to put him in jail forever. This is a victimless crime. I will tell you, I have articles in JSTOR. I have never been paid one goddamn cent. I have peer-reviewed articles that show up in JSTOR. I have never been paid one goddamn red cent. You know, Taylor and Francis does not need my money. They don't. It's like most of this research available through tools like JSTOR have been paid for by the public because they've been done in research institutions of higher education.
Sure.
So that's public knowledge that's behind a paywall. So people can't read it. So Aaron Schwartz made it available to people through this download server. And he was going to go to jail for 80 bajillion years. And he killed himself, right? But now we're like, no, everybody get out of the way because OpenAI has to have the entire internet. And by the way, human beings, all of it's still behind a paywall. So I want to know, why does ChatGPT get to read the entire archives of the New York Times, but I can't, right? So it feels like we're giving privileged access to corporate actors over individual actors, and that we're privileging the learning needs of a machine over the learning needs of human beings. Like when I'm at home and I'm searching for scholarly literature, I'll click on things and it's like, you can get this article for $40. And I'm like, bitch, please, I will not. And then I use the proxy server, right? Because my institution subscribes to a lot of these things. But who in God's green earth gets away with charging $40 for one research article on creative, nonlinear thinking and ADHD people, right? Like, no, thank you, please. So I feel like we're making an awful lot of allowances because it's super, super important for some reason that the AI get smarter, but it's not at all important that human beings get smarter or have their copyrights protected, right? Like and Jeffrey Hinton, who's like one of these guys who's like, should have known, because people have been saying for years, you know, if you do this, here's what's going to happen. He's like, I don't think so. I will take my giant cash payout. I'm going to have an auction for me and my team. And whatever company pays us the most money, that is going to be the company that me and my team are going to take our research to. And then exactly what happened was exactly what people had predicted was going to happen. He's like, oh no, and now I'm humongously rich and I have ethical qualms. So now I'm going to make a ton of money on the speaking circuit about what have I wrought. Like, see also Tristan Harris, right? Or Jaron Lanier, like these. Like, God spare me white dudes who spend 20, 30, 40 years cashing in while poo-pooing all like the feminists and the people of color and like the techno-skeptics. Like, you just don't love the future. And then they make their money. They get out and then they're like, did you know social media is maybe bad for us? Did you know harms can come with this? And I'm like, wow, you're going to gaslight me for 20 years about this and now you're going to charge $15,000 to make a speech where like black feminists were saying this a long time ago when you handed them off the internet? So it's like, that's a great racket. I would love to get in on that action.
Really? Would you? I know some people.
You know some people. Yeah. I'm like, sell out for a bit. So then I can just turn around and say, I know all the secrets because I built these torture doom devices. And now I'm going to tell you, while counting my money, how bad these things are for you. Mm-hmm. You got me going. This is on you.
I did. I really did. So what's your research focus now? What are you outside of Bitch Please?
Here's what I'm into. I'm into Touch Grass is my mood now, right? So Touch Grass is, I mean, the kids are saying to each other on the internet, and he's like, you're way too online. You've lost touch with reality. You need to go outside and touch some grass, which is like a little bit about like, whoa, you're too online, and a little bit drawing from therapy speak. You know, you need to go outside and like take your shoes off and put your feet down on the ground, like feel grounded in the space and let the air circulate through your hair. So it's like a little bit therapy, a little bit get off the internet. And I've been doing some research where I'm thinking about things that tools have provided to us in the form of convenience within a generation render extinct the skill that it offered a convenience break from, and then they become compulsory. So think about cooking. So the age that we are, our moms went back to work and it was often they would microwave stuff, or my mom would cook, but was coming home from work and would cook and nobody was allowed to be in the kitchen. And people our age often did not learn how to cook, but it was okay. We had lean cuisine in a microwave. And so there's a whole generation of people don't know how to cook. They stopped teaching cursive or penmanship at all in schools, which appalls me because I do calligraphy. The system of handwriting was meant to be ergonomic and pleasurable. So insofar as they teach it at all, still it's just they give a sheet of reference letters and just like, we'll make this however you can. And I watch my students, they're pressing so hard that the paper is curling. And if you flip it over, it's like Braille on that side. Like their hands are cramped and they're all crunched and stuff. So people don't know how to do that. But we also didn't teach them touch typing. Do you know? My sewing machine that I inherited from my mom has an 80-page manual with it. That's quite detailed because this is a very mechanical, entirely made of steel device. It's in a wooden box and it requires skill to operate. And the manual assumes that you know what sewing is, that it treats you as if you are an expert and that the machine is augmenting your ability rather than automating it. I have a buttonholer, a mechanical buttonholer you attach to the machine, and it's 38 pages, the manual for that. And I just got a new iPad and I got two stickers and a statutory declaration about how I shouldn't eat the batteries.
And a very fine print EULA you're never going to read.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's it. And I'm like, this machine is so easy to use that it's simple. A news reporter asked me about this study that just came out about when people go online to try to fact check whether something is fake news or not, they do worse at guessing whether it's fake news or not than if they don't do any research. And
really?
Yeah, Matthew, do you know what they're putting in the search bar? The URL of the thing they're trying to check.
No.
Yeah, they are. It would never occur to me to do that because that's on the face of it stupid. Or they take the title. It'll be something like, because that fake news ecosystem has a controlled vocabulary. They all use the same words. So if you take the title of like fascist Trudeau engineers lockdown globalist plot, if you take that title, which is the next thing that people do, and paste that in the search bar, guess what? You're going to get a ton of confirmatory stuff because like things like, you know, the Blaze and the Rebel, they just all reprint each other's stuff. You'd be like, wow, 100 hits. This must be true. And I was like, oh, people aren't taught how to search for things. Remember, like we started at York, there was still the card catalog in the year they were switching over between the computer one that was kind of hinky and not very reliable and the card catalog. And I was, oh, nobody's teaching anybody how to do this, how to search. How do you, when you are not sure if something is real, how would you look for it in a way that wouldn't just feed you back exactly what you typed in? Google is very easy to use, but it's not a simple thing to do search. An iPad is very easy to use, but like, why is my dad telling me he got hacked because people are talking about his trip to Florida on his Facebook, but he never told anybody he was going to Florida, except he typed Marco Island rentals into a Facebook status update instead of a Google search. That's how it is. We've made these things incredibly easy to use. And we've taken all the smarts out of the people. You know, if I'm going to operate my sewing machine, I need to know what I'm doing, or A, it's not going to move at all. it will seize up. If I don't thread it correctly, it's not going to work. And then I have to troubleshoot it. And if I'm not paying attention while I'm doing it, I'm going to pierce my own finger with a sewing needle. It's a very mechanical process that I have to kind of respect. Research.
Getting that thread in the bobbin.
It's like, I had to like check my manual. I still check the manual because I'm like, do I flick this switch or not? Like, I can't quite remember.
Go up or down?
Exactly. Does it go up or down? Like, I'm not sure. Like, is the needle supposed to move when I'm doing this? Did I disengage the drivetrain? Like, because you sort of have to have a mental model of it.
On the top of the back, on the bottom.
We don't have a mental model of most virtual things. We don't have a mental model. It's like behind a glass screen. So I'm really thinking about skill and learning. I'm playing piano again. I took it up during the pandemic because I had my eyes lasered and I couldn't read or watch TV. I'm going to be like Stevie Wonder. I can't see anything, but I'm going to play the piano. So I've been taking lessons for 3 years again. And it's like kind of astonishing to me how much you learn in your body. You ever like turn the water on in the shower when you're waiting for it to get hot before you get in? And you can smell when the water gets hot, but you don't realize that what you're smelling is the volatile organic compounds that are coming off from the heat. It's a skill that you know when the water is ready. Like, you don't need an app on your phone linked to a sensor in the shower head that's going to tell you like it's hot enough. You kind of know. Like, or like I teach yoga. I'm trained as a yoga teacher. And often students like would ask me questions about, oh, when I do this, it feels like this. And I'm like, show me. And I want to look at their body while they do it because words are not going to do that. And then before I solve it for them, I would find that I'm kind of rolling my eyes back in my head, but then I'm doing the pose because the knowledge is stored in my body. I have to replicate the pose they're trying to do. And as I'm moving around, I'm like, oh, I think I know what's happening. And then I can name the muscle, but it's not just living in my abstract brain. Do you know what I mean? It's in part of my embodied knowledge of things. And I worry what happens when we are now increasingly foregrounding eyeballs and fingertips. Those are the only two body parts that are essential to stuff. And I'm like, what happened to knowing that you need to refill the salt because when you picked it up, it wasn't very heavy, or you can smell when the shower is hot enough, or my piano teacher is teaching me how to, it's actually called attack the notes differently to produce different kinds of sounds. And I mean, you could program it on a MIDI probably, but there's something that's deeper in the kind of knowing that comes from trying to fit your body to an analog device that can't do it without you, but you can't do it without that. Like driving a stick shift. You know, like, you know, one stick shift, you can drive all of them, but like you get a feel for where the clutch catches the first couple times in somebody else's car, but your feet know, you know, like you can feel when an engine is going to catch, or you can sort of hear where the rumbling is at, or the vibration in the car lets you know. And I think a lot of our digital environments are remarkably impoverished compared to the material world.
I know exactly what you mean. Although it's not a manual, I have a vintage pickup truck up north. When I told my brother-in-law, who is very much gearhead and loves his, you know, high performance Porsche, he's like, that's not going to drive well. I'm not buying it because it's going to drive well. Like, I don't expect it to be a sports car. Yeah. It's a truck that's 43 years old. I expect it to weave and wobble and that the steering should be loose. It shouldn't be exact. It should be uncomfortable and people should be afraid of me coming down the highway. They should be afraid because it is made of metal. It's steel. It would severely damage you.
Probably too, because it won't crumple correctly.
I think it may be from the era where there's probably enough metal in the truck. I'll be fine. Like, I will be fine. Mm-hmm. On the other side, not so much.
Okay.
But also you can feel things. And even because some of its parts are old and even its gear shift, it's not perfect. Mm-hmm. Like, you do have to feel it into drive. The actual indicator isn't accurate. I'm like, I know it's in drive when I go here.
So you're in symbiosis with this.
Yeah.
You've put in the time. You have a relationship with this.
It's drive, mine.
Right?
It is mine. We are each other.
I bet you can like rock yourself out of a rut in it.
You know, I haven't had opportunity to do that, thankfully. And I think it's, you know, years of driving have prevented me from, unlike my mother's tempo, in which case I had in my 20s and then my teen years, you know, I put that tempo through a lot of the truck has not had that experience. I treat it much better than any vehicle I've ever owned.
No, you'd probably have to because it's so old.
It is in such good shape. It's so weird. Well, and so touch grass. Mm-hmm. Are you going to, is there research work you're doing on this?
I am. I'm thinking about it. I've been doing a lot of research into embodied cognition. I've been learning about, you know, they say like what distinguishes the human animal from other animals is the capacity for language. And there's a theory pretty well supported that the capacity for language is an excess functionality in the brain and that our brains get bigger. Our brains are fundamentally a control system for the body that moves it through space, prevents us from getting eaten, and finds us enough food. That's what the body does. And that as our hands developed, the ulnar twist, where you can twist your palms up and down, or where you can actually tie a bow in an apron behind your own back, that the control system required to operate those hands, where you can reach behind your head and do a braid in your own hair, or you can look at a baseball coming towards you, and then at a certain point, you stop looking at the baseball and you put your hand out in exactly the right spot to catch it. That type of control is incredibly taxing metabolically, and we require much bigger brains to operate our hands. We have three types of grip in our hands, like the pincer grip, the three chuck grip. Like there's different ways that we can hold our hands that are very unusual. There are ways that, you know, we have the full motion through our shoulder blades and more bend in the elbow. It makes us less strong physically. We can't run as fast or like throw things as hard, but it gives us this tremendous capacity for minute types of movement that required a lot more brain. So the idea is like possibly language is what the excess capacity did once we learned we got a brain big enough to control our human hands. And I've been reading about how people learn better when they take notes by hand versus take notes. I mean, the research is incredibly clear on this now, like unequivocally. You can take pictures of the board, doesn't work. If you write it down in your own words, you don't get as much down, but you're actively processing it. And there's something about the act of inscription where you've embodied this knowledge literally and trying to put it down on paper, choosing which words to listen to, that makes the knowledge stick. Having physical objects to refer to, I don't know about you, I have like bookshelves that are off the chain. I have so many books and my ADHD brain can't remember shit, but I will go up to my bookshelf and I be like, it's in the upper right quadrant. I think it's blue. And I will just run my fingers along it and find it. Or I'll have a memory when I'm trying to remember something inside a book. And I'll be like, it was in the last half. It was like either on the recto or the verso. And I'm like, I know I put a bunch of pen marks down the side. But there are interactions with the physical world is where substantial amounts of cognition happen. So that's where I'm reading about the ways that we learn with our bodies that are not simply abstract reasoning.
Like an epistemology of physicality?
Yeah. I think there's a kind of chauvinism about learning, you know, cogito ergo sum. Like, I think, therefore I am. But it's like you think with your hands as well as with your logic brain. There's gender issues here. There's positionality issues too, that people in different bodies know things in different ways. I could tell you the note that my fridge hums at. I could tell you the note that the building down the street hums at when it when it's quite windy, because I have hyperacusis, I'm very sensitive to sounds around me and I hear things that other people don't hear. It's in the environment, they're just not hearing them and I hear them. And that's a kind of knowledge I have of my environment that other people don't have. And it's an embodied way of knowing. And so I'm interested in thinking about thinking as exceeding like just sitting down and like squinching your nose up and going like, thanks. I was like, I can do that. That's like my whole job is that. But I become aware that when I play piano, my hand knows how to do things that my brain can't keep up with. It can't. I play faster than I can make conscious choices, but my hands know. My teacher says, you have to put it in your hands first. Put it in your hands. I'm trying to do the expression. He's like, no, you haven't got the song in your hands. That's such a weird way of putting it. I mean, but he's right. You play faster than you can think. I've started drawing. I'm taking lessons now. And you use a different part of your brain when you're drawing than when you're producing linear text. It's different. So much of what we look at, we're interpreting with our eyes. You look at something, a shape on your desk, and you're like, that's a coffee cup. And if you try to draw it, often you draw what the abstract image, the category image, the universal symbol of coffee cup in your head, you try to draw that. And then you look at the coffee cup on your desk and you're like, they don't look anything alike. What did I do wrong? Because drawing requires you to observe what is, not interpret the nature of the object from binocular vision. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's been incredibly humbling to do that. But I notice now that I'm getting better at it, that as I move through the world, even when I'm not drawing, I see things differently. I know things differently because I can look at them as if I was going to draw them. And they look different to me now. And it's like, huh. How did I learn that? My hand learned that, or my eyeballs learned that? My perceptual system? It's giving me access to new ideas because I've changed something in my body.
It's the collective exercise, probably. It's not one or the other. Yeah. It's probably the, you know, the whole of the thing is giving you a different way of looking at things.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at in the research. I'm trying to come at it from a critical disability studies place as well. Probably surprising no one. I got diagnosed after my kid who got diagnosed as autistic and ADHD. And I kept telling people, I don't understand how that could be. She's just like me. I don't know. I don't see it. It's just like, I was exactly like this. And I was like, it took me a really long time. And I was like, she's just, oh, shit. I went through all of that. And I've sort of become aware of the differences in how people interact with the world based either on the bodies or the brains that they come with, and the many different ways of knowing that are not always supported by an idea of thinking as something that has to be done quickly, abstractly, and purely cognitively in those ways, or like just typing and looking at screens is going to cover the full capacity of what human thoughts are capable of achieving. I think we can think with our feet. I think there's a reason Charles Darwin used to take 3-hour walks every day. Maybe just thinking there, it was like our shower thoughts, right? Except every day, it was like, that's where it happened.
He wasn't showering. He wasn't showering.
He was, yeah, he didn't. Yeah, that's right. He wasn't showering.
If he had showered, he probably could have gotten away with 2.5-hour walks.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. But doing the walking to do the thinking. So that's kind of where I'm at, which is like scary because I'm supposed to be the computer person. I'm supposed to be good at, I teach social media courses. I teach like digital.
Don't pigeonhole yourself, Amy. Yeah. You can be more than the computer person. Yeah. I believe it.
I guess so.
I believe.
It's like, these are the courses I have to teach. And I like made my social media students the other day draw their own hands. It was humiliating for them. It was great. I'm like, you're looking at it. Your hand's right in front of you. What did you draw? An abomination? Yes, you did. So.
But that's also teaching. Even throwing in those things that are not so, may not be part of the learning objectives of the course, are still learning opportunities.
Yeah. Metacognitive, learning how to learn kind of thing. Oh, you like this one. I have one for you. I give this to my computer science students. Okay. I was like, a proposition. Give me a proof for this. Knitting Mittens is a slow motion yarn-based 3D printer. Discuss.
Mittens is a slow motion 3D printer.
Yeah, yarn based slow motion.
Yarn based
3D printer.
Yeah, that's. I mean, you could think about that a lot. There's probably a bunch of those things.
Well, I love what you immediately, like, your eyes darted off into the thinking place, and you're like, whoa. Right? That's all I want for people.
You could lose yourself in that thought for a long time. There could be a lot. Yeah, I work with a guy who's working on solving a complex 3D printing problem, and so.
You should take up knitting, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This morning, knowing that we were going to chat, I did an online self-ADHD assessment. It told me I probably have ADHD, which is not really a surprise. It suggested I talk to my doctor about that. But you didn't know? You didn't think? I could have told you. I don't think we had words. ADHD wasn't a thing we talked about.
Not for girls, for sure.
For anyone.
For anyone, but, yeah.
So my son, grade one or grade two teacher, was like, there's a problem with your son, and I'm going to document it. It's be tested to the nth degree till we find out what is wrong with him. So first see the GP and do the ear and, you know, nose, like do the whole can he see, can he hear, can he speak, exercise, and then off to this specialist for other things, and then another specialist, and then another, and then that specialist referred to another, and it went on for at least a year, if not a year and a half. And the final diagnosis was he was 8. Yeah, it turns out your son is 8 years old. We will just chalk this up to he is 8. And I mean, that was many years ago. He's not 8 anymore. Now he's 15 going on 30. But so I guess I have to go and talk to my doctor. Any recommendations? What should I do with my self-diagnosis of ADHD?
Your self-diagnosis. Be kind to yourself. Like, be kind to yourself. Like, I think this may be the case with you too, is nobody ever flagged us for this because we're academic high achievers. I'm an academic high achiever who writes everything 5 minutes before the deadline because I really wanted to start it 6 weeks ago. And every day in the interim, I wanted to start it, but somehow couldn't make myself. So I have learned that, first of all, prescription amphetamines are great. I started taking my meds.
Prescription amphetamines are great.
They are great. So, like, I don't know if you remember, but I used to drink coffee before bed because it would calm me down. Like, this is paradoxical reaction to stimulant medication. People, like, with ADHD, you may, like, one of the things they ask adults often doing the diagnosis process, like, have you ever done cocaine? What did that feel like for you? Because people who do cocaine with ADHD are like, you know what? I finally have the focus to sit down and go through my inbox. So, like, the way amphetamines affect people who do not have ADHD are not how they affect people with ADHD. And I'll tell you, when my meds got to the right dose, I was like, motherfucker, is this how people go through life? Like, without this gap between attention, do you know how long that I can sit on the footstool outside of my bathroom in my robe and not shower?
Just like Darwin.
Because it feels like a lot. Just like Darwin, I'm going to go for that 3-hour walk and I'm not going to shower. Like, so yeah, I've had to learn the meds can help. Self-knowledge helps. Therapy helps because you learn a lot of weird coping skills that are really based on your disability that are not maybe super functional once you have better control of yourself. And I also learned that I do things differently than other people. And that's okay. I do things differently. I am writing a paper right now about ADHD writing styles, and all of my headings are from the 1990 Pet Shop Boys album Behavior, from the song Being Boring, because I produce what's called a literary conceit, which is an elaborate and far-flung metaphor, which is an intellectual exercise in making the juxtaposition apt, because that makes it interesting enough for me to write the paper, because I can't write it just because it's important. And I can't write it if it's going to be easy. It's so easy. Just sit down and do it. I'm like, yeah, I know. They're like, you already know what you need to know. I'm like, yeah, but I can't do it because I'm so bored. I'm going to die. But now I'm like, I can only use Pet Shop Boys lyrics for headings. And I have to make that work in the intro. And then in the conclusion, I'm like, oh, now it's interesting to me. So I always have to set things on triple challenge level so that sometimes to people, it looks like I'm showing off. But it's, I can do it like that, but I cannot do it. I mean, the other way.
You are showing off your knowledge of Pet Shop Boy song titles. Yeah.
I am. And they were showing off their knowledge of Zelda Fitzgerald, actually.
I was challenged once during a work lunch many, 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 many years ago to only speak in song lyrics. I was like, that is so easy. That is so easy. Are you kidding me? That is the easiest thing ever. And so I did that for an entire hour over lunch. And at the end of it, the person who challenged me to do that was like, it could have been physics, right? Like, you could have committed that same mental energy to, like, physics or any other discipline, and you chose song lyrics.
Or did song lyrics choose you? You can ask my family. They're always going bananas because every occasion, I've got science for any occasion. It's Beastie Boys, Paul's Boutique, which I know the whole album by heart, and you'd be surprised how often it is germane. I just did an academic article on AI and writing where I had 2 Beastie Boys quotes in it as illustrative of my mood. And then I have them in the work cited.
Beastie Boys, Paul's Boutique. I like it.
1989. Yeah, it was great. From, yeah, sure. Echolalia. I could talk in song lyrics all day. And that's fun.
What did you call you call you commented on Twitter again when I was I think I had just commented about how I'd just finished university, and you call it something like taking a Matthew, giving a Matthew to your students. What is that?
Doing a Matthew. You pulled a Matthew is what you did. Oh, you know exactly what pulling Matthew is. Like I tell my students about you. You are legend in my class. As I tell my grad students especially, I'm like, sometimes you have to pull a Matthew, which is like, you take the assignment and you're like, I'm going to do something different here, which is like your classic move. And you're like, oh, I built this history paper. They want this, but I think I'm going to write it as a primary document, not as a research paper. And you're either going to get an A+ or an F-. That is bullying a Matthew, right? Because you're a bit tricky like that. You're always like, oh, I'm just like a little bit different, right? You're in the office hours, you're meeting the teachers, you're like, learn about stuff. You're like, I could, you know, do something creative here. Which I'm always telling my students that they should try more, because either they're going to get an A+, it'll be exciting, or they'll have like what my friend Frankie calls a learningful failure, right? Where you get more out of it by trying to bend it. Yeah, trying to bend it to what you want means you probably learned more than a paper you got like an A+ on for following all the rules on autopilot. I tell my students about that all the time. I'm like, listen, you got to pull a Matthew. I had this friend when I was in university, and I tell them about you. I also tell them about my husband, who once was trying to get pickles and cucumbers on his Subway, and his coworker was with him, was like, why both? And he's like, I like them both. And she's like, well, pickles are cucumbers. And he was like, what?
I mean, that happens. I don't know if you remember this. I went with some of our mutual friends to see, what movie was that? I think it was True Romance in the theater. And then that's one of those, it had such a crazy ensemble cast. And I walked out of the theater and we were talking about how great that movie was and how much we loved it. And I said, you know what? That was so good. But I have two questions. Who played Elvis and where was Val Kilmer? And it hadn't occurred to me at that moment, until I said it out loud, that I'm like, oh. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
That answer. Yeah, withdrawn. Withdrawn. I would like to say that I was joking there, but I wasn't. Oh, that's amazing. I love that. See, sometimes you have to like take the knowledge and turn it into words outside of your mouth. And as soon as they come out of your own.
Well, again, it's either an A+ or an F. You're either really happy about that or it's either an A+. Well, Amy, I think we should probably draw this podcast close. So. Thank you for indulging me, and thanks for this so much in here.
Thank you for having me on.
And there you have it. That's how the conversation went. I wasn't sure when I first recorded this if I agreed with Amy about her view on AI, but as time has gone on and I've had some time to think about it, I think I do agree that what the large language models does or doing is not writing. It isn't writing. It is plausible sentence generation, and that they are going to have a problem in the future because so much other content that is being added to the models is also being generated by the AI. So it's hard to know where that all goes. I want to thank Amy again for taking all this time and spending this time with me. It was good to catch up. It was good to talk to her, to exercise those mental muscles again. If you want to stay in touch with me and hear some of the other things I have to say, you can join my newsletter at growdy.wtf, growdy.wtf. What the fuck? And also, I want to thank Dark Tapes again for the music that's provided for my podcast. Thank you for listening. And remember that you can find the Change Optimist podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Follow me there.